from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
A new book on Pope Francis sparks fresh controversy over the direction of the Church. And this week on Register Radio, we find out from Register Senior Editor Joan Desmond what the book has to say about the Pope. And almost a year after the convocation of Catholic leaders, we discuss with Jonathan Reyes from the U.S. Bishops' Conference whether the historic gathering has achieved its goals. Hello, I'm Matthew Bunsen, EWTN senior contributor and senior editor of the National Catholic Register, filling in this week for my co-host Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the Register, who's off. New York Times columnist and author Ross Douthat has a new book out on Pope Francis, To Change the Church, Pope Francis and the Future of Catholicism, a provocative take on Pope Francis and the theological crisis that has been sparked by this unprecedented pontificate. To talk about Douthat's book, I'm joined by Register Senior Editor Joan Desmond. Welcome back to Register Radio, Joan.
Hi, Matthew. Happy to be here.
Well, the Register has a piece online right now at ncregister.com on Ross Douthat's take on where Pope Francis is taking the Church, an interview with the author by Celeste Behe. Douthat says in the interview, the Church will either have to tacitly repudiate his innovations in order to restore consistency and continuity, or else follow them further to where they seem to lead, in which case his impact will be genuinely revolutionary. That seems to be sort of the thrust of the book, doesn't it?
Yeah, I would agree. But the book also tries, I think, at different points to offer various points of view and provide what the author, I think, would be, you know, would say is an honest take to almost argue both sides while clearly choosing one over the other.
Yeah, what is your general view of his premise? I mean, is it something that you would agree with, or is there something missing here?
I don't know. I actually follow him carefully. I read his columns. I like him. I don't always agree with him. But I think if there's what's interesting about the book is, first, it's highly readable. So all his kind of analysis, both of the present and the past and the connections and, you know, the contradictions and the similarities between this time and other times with other kinds of debates on theology, very important matters, everything from usury and religious freedom to other debates, the Jansenist debate over whether the Church should come down harder and insist on greater adherence to Church teaching or relax in certain ways to accommodate cultural change. I think, you know, he deals with that well. I had no trouble getting through the book. What I found hard is a little bit of an airless kind of cultural analysis that I think it's the culture war stuff. You know, we've been dealing with it for so many years, and there's so many different books and so many different columnists and commentators handling this topic. At times, we kind of know all this, and we're sort of saying, is there something more here? Or I kind of know this story.
Yeah, his love of history is very apparent in this book, and he focuses in particular, I know you want to talk about the idea of the Jansenists versus the Jesuits in the 17th and 18th centuries, especially the 17th century. What is his take on that, and why is it relevant to today?
Well, you're a church historian, so you could probably better address that, Matthew. But just as a layperson who doesn't know history that well, let me give you my take, and then you can correct me. I think just a thumbnail version is that he looks at the Jansenist heresy. And what's interesting, I thought I knew what the Jansenist heresy was, and what I realized is I didn't know what it was. But as he describes it, the Jansenists opposed the Jesuits, and they argued that the Jesuits were being too lax and allowing, especially in France in some places, allowing Catholics to be Catholic while doing some questionable things. And they, the argument is that, you know, we have a cultural crisis here, and so we have to adhere to the Church's teaching, come what may, and not accommodate this kind of behavior. So if that means a smaller church, so be it. That's how he would sort of sum up the Jansenist position. Mm-hmm. And the Jesuits said, no, you know, this is a pivotal moment, and we have to accommodate that and not lose the flock. Mm-hmm. So that's the argument. And he says, yeah, that argument sounds similar today in some ways, with people suggesting that it's just not going to work to demand certain moral teachings be adhered to at a time when people are, you know, contracepting, engaging in premarital sex, and then getting married in the church. Many of them barely even know what the church is teaching on divorce is, or they vaguely understand it, or they don't understand it at all. And just take a different tact. Go to the peripheries. Be what the prodigal brother should, the brother of the prodigal son should be, somebody more accommodating, more concerned about engaging in accompaniment. And so that's kind of the contemporary context for this. And then, but then he makes this interesting point that, while people might say, well, the Jesuit position is turned out to be correct, and the church supported that position, i.e. accommodate a certain degree of laxity. In reality, it's not quite like that. How did you read that?
Yeah, exactly. So that the Jansenists, if you're taking the argument to its logical conclusion, he's saying that the liberals would say that the Jansenists were defeated, that this is what the church was teaching. In fact, there were good reasons why the Jansenists were condemned, as they were. And I think it's something of a stretch from the liberal position to say that the Jesuits were themselves proposing a deterioration of church teaching. What we're trying to find clearly in this debate was what the church actually and authentically believed, which strikes me as the ongoing argument that we're still facing today.
Interesting. Yeah, I think that's a good summary of where it is. So it's a worthwhile read. I don't think anyone will feel that they're bogged down in that sense. It's mostly, do you feel your soul has been nurtured? Is there something new you've learned? That part is what maybe you might struggle with.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think about that?
Well, you know, I agree. And one of the things that I found in this book is that it all has this buildup to those final chapters where he talks about the legacy of Francis. And I know we only have a few minutes here, but this idea of a truce and kind of the failure of John Paul II and Benedict XVI to really defend or advance the conservative Orthodox position coming out of Vatican II.
What I'm finding this whole year as we engage on a lot of these issues, whether it involves controversies in Rome or Humanae Vitae or other things, is there's a lot of confusion about what we are trying to get to. What do we want at this moment, and what is most likely to be the correct interpretation of the Second Vatican Council? And I think a lot of people did think that John Paul and Benedict had resolved these questions. And I remember talking to Rusty Reno, the editor of First Things, and he said one conclusion he had reached was that these controversies hadn't really been adequately resolved.
Mm-hmm.
And now they've come roaring back. So there's probably something to that. I think, you know, some would argue the church is a big tent and we're going to have to accommodate a variety of different positions within the church, within reason, obviously. And one of those is, you know, the Second Vatican Council may have more than one meaning, more than one interpretation. So I don't know. I've really struggled with that question. I also thought there were, what did you think about his thoughts and his sort of critique of Orthodox Catholics during this period?
Yeah, I tend to agree with some of his conclusions regarding Orthodox Catholics. That's, I think there's a lot of work to be done. And one of the, mm-hmm. the hallmarks, I think, of this era is the desperate need for clarity. And we are in an unclear age in all sorts of different ways. And if there was ever a time we needed the greatest clarity possible, it's today within the church.
I guess a Catholic who has really embraced Pope Francis's vision would also say clarity and mercy or accompaniment, whatever you want to call it. And that's something I feel like at both a personal level and as I've engaged with things I've in the church over the past couple of years in the Francis Pontificate, that message of mercy has been important. The whole year of mercy, opening the doors of mercy. I do work with outreach for mm-hmm. women coming out of prison, and it meant a lot to them.
Yeah.
And you know, this year, one message that I am getting in stories and you know when I'm talking to sources is the momentum for that year of mercy, for the joy of the gospel, for, you know, all the ways that the church needs to effectively reach the peripheries while affirming its fundamental teachings. Is that momentum stalled as the controversies start to overwhelm and distract?
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. Well, Joan, we're going to have to leave it there. I would send everyone to ncregister.com to read the interview with Russ Douthat by Celeste Behe. That's Russ Douthat's take on where Pope Francis is taking the church. Well, Joan, thanks again for your time.
It's always a pleasure, Matthew.
Well, when we come back, I'm joined by Jonathan Reyes of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. We talk about the legacy of the Convocation of Catholic Leaders a year on. This is Register Radio. More when we return.
Father Wade Menezes talks about the National Catholic Register.
As the National Catholic Register celebrates its 90th anniversary, I think that says a lot about the publication. It works. It's solidly Catholic. It presents the teachings of the Church, unabashedly so, and also guides its readers to be even more solidly Catholic themselves. One of the major effects that I think the Register has on its readers is that it elevates the intellect. Whether it be a faith item or a news item, it presents the news and the faith item in a very balanced way. One thing that the Register can never be accused of is being too far left or too far right. It is solidly Catholic, right in line with the Chair of Peter, and I think that says a lot about the Register.
For a 6-issue free trial of the National Catholic Register, go to ncregister.com and click on the 6 free issue banner or call 800-421-3230 for your 6 free issues. And as you await your first issue, enjoy some of our online content.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back to Register Radio. I'm Matthew Bunsen, senior editor of the National Catholic Register, flying solo this week as Jeanette DeMello is off. Almost 1 year ago, Catholic leaders from across the United States gathered in Orlando, Florida, the unprecedented convocation to galvanize American Catholics toward evangelization in the 21st century. What have been the fruits of the convocation, and what are its long-term prospects? To find out more, I'm joined by Jonathan Reyes of the USCCB, who was one of the chief organizers of the event. Jonathan, welcome to Register Radio, and I'm very grateful for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, your full title is Assistant General Secretary for Integral Human Development for the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. That is something of a mouthful. Could you describe in half an hour, if possible, everything that you do for the bishops?
It is a long title. Basically, my areas of responsibility are Department of Justice and Peace, which is sort of international domestic policy and educational issues, and then our Government Relations Office as well falls under that. But the title itself is really Integral Human Development. That's a term that comes from Benedict XVI and the new dicastery in Rome that they've named Integral Human Development.
Well, I was going to say that there is this new dicastery that is pulling together a lot of the similar resources that you oversee here. So it must be interesting to have sort of a direct parallel on the Vatican side with Cardinal Turkson.
That's right. So it was sort of the same image of bringing, that's what integral, you know, bringing these things together is. Some things that had been in, you know, different buckets that there's a good logic to have them all together because they're all related to the human being, human flourishing, and ultimately human flourishing in Christ. So brings them all together nicely. And it's been a real joy to do it. Still learning the job, but I'm really enjoying it.
And you come on board after many years of experience at the conference. I know, I think you've been with the conference, what, since 2012, is that right?
That's right. That's right.
Talk about the sort of the evolution, in a way, of integral human development in light of we have a movement from Pope Benedict XVI to Pope Francis. We have all of these crises, but there really is that sort of internal continuity, isn't there?
Right. I think there's a wonderful line from Pope Francis where he just says, everything is connected. And one of the things that's been observed for a long time in the Church and by the Holy Fathers going back is the need to bring together these different concerns around a vision of what a human being is and what it means for the human being to flourish and development. So it's not just that he's an economic human being over here and there's a person who gets married over there, et cetera. But it's the whole human person. So bringing things together that keep getting separated. And the vision is, let's care for the whole person, all people, and in a full way, which means including both their material development, but also their spiritual development. So it's just sort of a beautiful vision of sort of putting together the human being again in a way that I think, for a lot of different reasons, human beings have been broken into different parts.
And you sit at kind of a nexus between public policy, the work of the conference, and Catholic social teaching, don't you?
Right, and they're obviously very related, and so it's nice to have them in conversation with one another, because the Catholic social teaching is what informs that policy, and those policy moves with various prudential judgments are made there, but it's the Catholic social teaching that's the heart of it. And it's really that that holds the whole thing together. And I think really one of the missions of the office is to make Catholic social teaching more known for its richness and what it offers to a vision of a healthy human life.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the tasks that you had in the last couple of years was putting together what by, I think, universal acclamation was the immensely successful convocation in the summer of 2017 in Orlando. Let's revisit that a little bit. What was this convocation for people whose memories may be a little dim at this point?
Well, it was in fact, a very a bold effort by the bishops, which was to do something they hadn't done in 100 years and to bring together leaders from the church throughout the whole country to really engage the theme of missionary discipleship, the apostolic letter of Evangelii Gaudium, and what it means to live as missionary disciples right now. And so we had leaders from every sort of aspect of the church's mission, from many different points of views, and we brought them together to encounter Christ together, encounter one another together. We had quite a few bishops, most dioceses represented. It was really a remarkable gathering, unlike anything else. And like most of these things, I mean, one of the things we said as we were praying for it was, Lord, we'll bring this thing together, we'll do our best to do it, but we really need you to bless it. This is for you to advance, for us to listen to you and for you to advance the mission of the church. And I just have to say, a lot of the success was simply due to God's direct intervention, and there's a ton of little stories that would illustrate that, but everyone there, I think, experienced it as a real work of the Holy Spirit and a great moment for the church.
Well, I was there, as you know. I had the privilege of actually being a panelist at one point. And I remember you and I having a very brief conversation because you were running for almost the entire duration of this convocation. But how amazing it was to watch how this took on a life of its own, especially given the fact that no one was really quite sure what this was going to look like or how it was going to turn out.
Absolutely. That was everyone who was involved in the planning of it, that was our experience. It was more than we imagined, and there were a lot of questions around it. What is this really? What does it mean to bring leaders together? Who's a leader? So the number of questions going into it that were answered in extraordinary ways, I think, is just a sign of really God's providential hand on it. And the fact that it's now bearing fruit, that we're hearing stories of different dioceses holding their own diocesan convocation, or gatherings based on and modeled on the convocation, or the teams that went from diocese now have been continuing to meet over the last months to take what they discussed and learned at the convocation and apply it in the diocese. So the fruit of it as well, I think, is testimony to the fact that God directed this thing and is using it for his glory. So we're deeply inspired by it. And we were also, our faith was just built up by it.
In the almost year since then, you've touched on the fact that a lot of dioceses are holding their own convocations. Was that in your blueprint? And what has happened in that this year since that has taken you by most surprise?
Yeah, blueprint is such a such a strong word. In our hopes.
So
in our hopes were two things. We had said from the very beginning that the convocation wasn't meant to for the USCCB to then take some sort of central role in national planning of a whole set of things. That was never its purpose. The purpose was to bring people together as teams from different dioceses or different ministries, and for it to be a moment for them to coalesce around a vision or deepen their vision or strengthen their ability to work together. We even had speakers, Patrick Lencioni, on teamwork and what it means to work. So some very practical things on that level. So they could take it back. It was to give them what they needed to sharpen the work they're doing in the diocese. And so that hope has been realized. And we have seen that in many, many places where teams are doing things, dioceses are doing things, bishops are initiating things that they would not have thought of had it not been for that. Our other hope was just to have a wide-ranging conversation for the church, which was to put people in touch with each other who wouldn't normally be in the same room. We said from the very beginning, we're going to bring people together who don't sit in the same meetings, even in their own diocese usually,
mm-hmm.
And this was now across the whole country, and this had a remarkable kind of fruitfulness to it. I think there was some anxiety. Oh, how are people going to do who represent different elements in the church or whatever? And I think the way we structured the conversations turned out to allow for some pretty open conversation and some freedom, and also some learning on everyone's end. And then the thing we're going to do on our end, we do have this lying behind the whole convocation, was a study we did called the Right Brain Study that was about really looking at the motivations of people for their love of the church, coming into the church, maybe leaving the church, et cetera, and to use that study to sort of shape the way we did it. Well, now we're going to start bringing that study to bear and for bishops in that, and start taking some of the results of that study and making them known and having them looked at, so that that's also another fruit of it. But that'll be over the course of the next few months.
Mm-hmm. And if we were to project out 5 or 10 years from now, what would you see the most ideal of the fruits from the convocation?
Number one, evangelization. The church exists in order to evangelize. So one of the first fruits would be that people would say 5 years from now, 10 years from now, that the convocation was a moment in the development of ministry in our diocese, where, or in our parish, or in our mission, where we connected with the right people, or we caught a vision for something that just led more and more souls to Jesus Christ and to the joy of encountering him and the joy of being in the church. So that's at the heart of everything. And also just to expand the vision of people in the church. The other thing I would love is just what's been kind of fun is to talk to people who are in one ministry who are saying, you know, there are things in this other area of ministry that I never thought of and that actually relate back to where we started the conversation, this notion of integration,
mm-hmm.
the integral view of the church. The church itself can sometimes get into silos, and this was meant to address that. So bringing people to Jesus Christ, opening the church up more to an integrated approach to whole human conversion, development, the life of love in the church.
How important is it for the average Catholic out there in the United States to understand the dimensions of why something like the Encuentro is so important?
Yeah, I think there's just a simple reality, which, I mean, this is their church. So to the extent they understand things going on in their church, I think it's essential. And one of the foundational realities of the church in the United States is the growing Latino presence and what this means for evangelization, for what it means for the way the church develops pastorally, for all these things that are going on in both the United States, but frankly globally, but in the United States in particular, for the way the church is really embracing the Latino community. And that's just a reality. So I think it's important to the extent they care about this, that the church as a whole, that they pay attention to this. And, you know, it affects a lot of parishes.
Mm-hmm.
And parishes not just on border states, but parishes in towns throughout the United States and the Midwest and the East Coast, and the West, et cetera, in the North. So I think it's really essential for a global church and for a communion like the Catholic Church to be very attentive to these developments.
And as a global kind of Catholic community, we are seeing this increasing diversity in the United States within the Catholic world. What lessons do we need to take from that, that we are seeing these individual groups coming together, but and yet we're still working toward that unity that we need to have as Catholics?
Well, maybe the lesson is the need for unity. I mean, I'm sure that many people are aware of the kind of increasing division just in general,
mm-hmm.
not just in our politics, but across sort of culturally the United States, and it's economic, it's political, it's ideological, et cetera. I think the church still remains the great sign of the unity of the human race, as it's been talked about and historically considered. This was always sort of the vision of the church to remind the human race, particularly in the 20th century and in Vatican II, that there's one human family here, that after all the ruptures of the first half of the 20th century, the church is a sign of unity. I think we need that just as much now.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a moment for the church to be a voice of unity for the world, not just for itself, but for the world. I can't tell you how significant I think that is. And to say that's somehow easy or just a nice sentiment, real unity takes work. And the church has the special graces, has the help of the Holy Spirit, has Christ at the center. It really can be a sign of unity for the whole human race. So I'm hopeful of that lesson and not just a lesson, but a testimony, be a testimony of true unity.
And that actually brings me to my very last question, which is, what can the average Catholic do to participate in that, to deepen their awareness of the faith, their love of the faith, but also to build that unity you're talking about?
Well, I think it's the nice name of this event coming up in Cuentro, which is just encounter, or some. It's almost better in Spanish to call it in English, finding of someone. I think that what we can do is to start even in our own parish, to deliberately make the effort, whether through any of the ministries or just in Mass, to encounter, to find one another. I think there's just a lot to be gained from the deliberate effort, stepping out of our own particular comfort zone, silos, whatever language we want to use, and engaging one another as Catholic, that Catholic who you wouldn't normally talk to, or step into a mission you've never done before, whether it's to those in need, or whether it's evangelization, or visiting a shelter, or visiting prison. So to encounter, to actually go out and make a deliberate effort to say, I will build unity here, starting in my family, but also in my parish. Here I will invest the time to have real relationship, a real encuentro, finding of one.
Yeah, to see that person, and in seeing that person, to see Christ.
Yeah, and you only do that by taking the time. You know, we walk past each other a lot, we stare at our phones a lot, we treat each other transactionally. I think the invitation is to treat one another as human beings so that we can actually see in them exactly what you said. Christ himself, and that's not just a neat metaphor, mm-hmm. but the reality that is Jesus Christ.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for the update on the convocation, but also for the information on the Encuentro. I know this is going to be a major topic of discussion over the next couple of months, so I look forward to having a further conversation with you.
Thank you for having me, Matt.
That does it for this week. Renewed thanks to Jonathan Reyes and to Joan Desmond. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining me on Register Radio here on EWTN. For Jeanette DeMello and our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Matthew Bunsen. Until next week, God bless.
The National Catholic Register is America's most complete Catholic news source with a comprehensive view of the world from a distinctly Catholic perspective. If it's shaping the world as we know it, you'll find it at ncregister.com.